Hey everybody, Tim Shum here. Thanks for tuning in again to Fireside Chicago. We're going to be talking to Rashid Hammouda today, co-founder and CEO of Bridge Financial Technology. Rashid and I have an interesting relationship. Many of you know I had a corporate career prior to leaving, waiting out a 2.5 year non-compete, and then starting the business that I currently have, Lucas James Talent Partners. In that 2.5 year stretch, I was a sales coach or a business coach to a lot of early stage companies. And Rashid and Bridge, I came across these individuals probably October 2016 and started my relationship. And what I saw in Rashid was an ambitious, young individual, but well beyond his years. In a lot of different contexts, mature in a business sense, mature in a humility sense, mature in an EQ sense, mature in a emotional sense. And I was like, this individual is going places. So we started the relationship there. I invested in the business. I wanted to take the ride with Rashid and his team. And if you fast forward 4 years later, they're building something great. And for those of you that want to be an entrepreneur, that maybe, you know, don't have a lot of corporate experience under your belt, I think you'll have a lot of takeaways from Rashid and his team, his insights into a lot of different things and what makes him successful and how he views the world. So I hope you enjoy the listen. And thanks again for tuning in. Ladies and gentlemen, Rashid Hammouda. How's it going, Rashid?
Good, Tim. Good to be with you today.
I'm so excited to have you on board. I said it in the intro, you and I go like way back, not like elementary school, preschool way back, but like corporate, you know, business way back. I think we met October of 2016.
Yeah, 2016. I was going to say, yeah, you're one of my oldest connects in the Chicago startup scene.
Let's just take that story a little bit because I think it's going to give context to what we're talking about. So a lot of the listeners know that I was in corporate America for 10 years, left to take an entrepreneurial journey myself. I left in January of 2016, started networking. We met at a cigar bar. I think
it's the only time I've been to a cigar bar.
I don't know if that's my scene, but you know, I like a cigar now and then. And we got to talking about your business a little bit and we set up a coffee meeting from there. And then, you know, since, you know, we've talked shop, you know, in a lot of different senses. And then, you know, fast forward 4 years, I've seen your company grow to what it's become today. So it's cool. We're going to get into that a little bit. For the listeners that don't know Rashid, don't know Bridge Financial Technology, why don't you give just a quick backstory on yourself and how maybe the co-founding team came together to found Bridge?
Sure. So I moved to Chicago in summer of 2015. Myself and some friends that ultimately became co-founders, we were just looking to actually do an operational turnaround in like a services company. So services bureau, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's like outsource business processing, right? Like, hey, I've got an operations team, like go outsource and do all that operations team for me. And you achieve some sort of economies of scale with them. Really old school business model, right? BPO stuff is not exactly the way of the future necessarily, because you can automate that with technology. And so I had a background in financial advising. I worked at PNC Wealth Management, learned sort of the trade there, and could see an opportunity where, hey, come and take a look at this outsourcing business and let us know if you think there's something here. So myself and my co-founders, Sanjay, Alan, and Adam, we all came together and were like, yeah, there's a great opportunity here. They're serving a part of the wealth management market that we'll talk about later, I'm sure, that's exploding in growth. It was the fastest growing. I think it is still the fastest growing segment of wealth management. But we're going to do a technology company. We're not going to do this operational crap. And so we created Bridge Financial Technology, totally new company, totally new technology. We spun out the basically like less than 10 clients, I think, at the time, and a couple of key industry relationships that helped us sort of leapfrog our company. You know, God, that was 5 years ago. So it's been a long, long ride since. We built the software from the ground up. we exploded in growth. We're over 200 clients today. So we serve wealth managers, enterprise customers, and now actually increasingly fintechs. So other fintechs that consume our technology to build their own software solutions on top of it. So yeah, I'll pause there. Happy to obviously elaborate. I know we're going to talk about a bunch.
I got a couple questions there. So how old were you when 2015, when this idea was coming together?
I was 24.
24 years old. Okay. So when I was 24, I wasn't thinking about how to acquire an old school BPO for a turnaround and then potentially find a technology idea around that. Like straight up, I was just trying to figure life out or whatever. And then when we met, regardless of your age, I was just super impressed with how you were thinking about things. And I, obviously more so since I've gotten to know you, but what led to that for you? I think a lot of the listeners are aspiring entrepreneurs, maybe just starting their own venture. You know, what led to that idea? And then like making it less scary, lowering the barrier to entry for you and Sanjay and Alan and your brother to make the leap.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, my co-founders had one of them I went to school with. The other one was my brother. And then Alan, our CTO, my co-founder, he's like a total startup guru. I mean, the guy, like, this is his third or fourth startup. So that helped having a co-founder that like made a bunch of mistakes. And I'd be like, okay, like Alan's been here before in some shape or form. But I'm an accidental founder. I'm not one of those people who set out at the beginning to be an entrepreneur, being a founder. You know, I grew up a little bit about my personal background. Like I grew up in rural Iowa, working in a family business as a restaurant. My dad's an immigrant. My mom's from the Midwest. They settled in, again, rural Iowa of all places, go figure. I just like building stuff and solving problems. And that's really the motivator for me and the drive internally for me. And like a lot of other founders, I think I can be obsessive about problems. And I was working in the wealth management space. And it was rough. Like the technology just didn't help us do our job. And it still doesn't in a lot of places, you know, and PNC has really powerful technology by all standards. I remember literally the last day I was leaving the office and my senior advisor who I worked under, he was like, so you're kind of like working on something, right? That's going to like replace all this crap that I'm dealing with every day. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, God, you guys can't get that done fast enough for me. And, you know, so it's like the last day I'm leaving this office and this guy who's been in the industry for 15, 20 years, who was my boss, was just like, you got to figure this out, basically, right? And it's really motivating as a young person. For me, again, you know, getting obsessive about problems and just I want to solve problems by building really compelling solutions. And a company happens to be a good way to do that for an industry if the problem is big enough. Yeah.
I can relate to this a little bit. You know, when you think of the idea of like, hey, college buddy, you and Sanjay and, you know, roping in Alan, roping in and your brother, like it's a four-headed monster at that point. But initially, just the thought of starting something when you don't have the playbook, like you don't have knowledge around that, like how do you finance this? How do you pay yourself eventually? How do you get your first customer? How do you create, you know, a job description for someone that you need to hire? Like these are so big, daunting tasks for a lot of people. You know, for you, was it, you know, did you read books? Was it podcasts? Did you have mentors along the way? What lowered that, that fear and that risk for you?
So I think the base level for me was being just kind of, ignorant, frankly, right? Like, you know,
when just naive.
Yeah. When you're 24, like you don't, like the thing I always say is like when I was younger and dumber than I am today, you know, I didn't know anything about fundraising. I didn't know anything about any of this stuff. And as long as you're just really open, like if you're focused on solving the problem that's driving you, and then you just be a sponge for everything, right? Everything that could possibly help you solve that problem, you're probably going to find the people and the resources that you need. So, you know, I'm a voracious reader. I'm consume a lot of like Zaster, a lot of first round review. Like there's a ton of good online resources. A really early book that I, or a book I should say that I read early in my time at Bridge that was pretty formative was Ben Horowitz's book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things, really well-known one for founders and entrepreneurs. The biggest takeaway from that for me early in my career was, here's this guy who's built, you know, a multi-billion dollar organization and sold it. And he's telling his readers like, hey, there's no playbook for this stuff, right? Like there are things that kind of work, right? Like, you know, like there are rules about writing a job description to make it good and stuff like that. But by and large, making a company successful, like there's not like follow these steps and we will become successful, right? And that kind of is an empowering thing to internalize. Because then it's like, okay, well, if there's not just like this checklist that exists in the universe for me to follow, then I get like the cool part of the job is like figuring it out, right? And when you're a sponge to any possible resource and you're constantly testing things and you have that continuous learning, continuous improvement mentality, you know, you're going to connect with great people. Connecting with you, honestly, early on, right? Like you guys were, you and your business partner, these were sales wizards. I didn't know anything about sales. I was running a threadbare process at best. Had early advisors to the company, Nathan Pinger, another great entrepreneur in the Chicagoland area who knew sales well. Other folks that helped advise us, Voss, Chi. I mean, we had early company advisors that had done startups before. And we just listened to them, right? And that doesn't mean we did everything exactly the way that they said it. But as much as you can learn from someone else's mistakes and just try and test things, right? And listen and listen and listen and meet with people, you're gonna lower the barrier to entry. At a minimum, you're gonna accelerate the learning curve for yourself.
You're so spot on. I remember distinctly like several conversations that I've had with people. And I think you have to go seek people that have experience in the area that you seek to be great at. And what I found when I have those conversations, I try to be a sponge and just pick their brain, pick their brain, pick their brain. I'm so sorry. I'm asking so many questions. This is great for me. But just, you know, the calmness and the attitude around, hey, yeah, the first 2 years like suck for a while. It's okay. But if you have a long-term outlook, you know, it's going to be okay as long as you do this and this and this. Yeah. Oh, you should talk to a bank about getting this kind of line of credit. That's what we did. And, mm-hmm. you know, so you can sleep at night this way. Those conversations are so impactful. And I think what differentiates someone like yourself versus someone that's trying to figure it out on their own or has so much ego in like around like failing mm-hmm. or trying new things or getting it out to the world. Like, I don't know the answer to this. You know, you're going to win every time because just like you said, you're going to short your learning curve. You're going to avoid mistakes. You're just going to get where you need to go a lot quicker and avoid some like major costly issues along the way. So I think you're spot on. What were some like, take me out of it, but what were some either pivots along the way or like just big learnings in your journey? Can you pinpoint a conversation or a piece of advice?
Gosh, that's a great question. You know, I can't remember if somebody said this to me or if it was a combination of a lot of conversations where this started to settle in. But at a certain point, I think, you know, and it might have been actually in the very early days talking to VCs and you know, getting your ass kicked a little bit in terms of feedback and people are crapping on your company. Like every founder who's tried to fundraise has experienced this. And this notion of, do you want to be right or do you want to win? Right? Like, do you want to be successful? Right. So and that's sort of to your point about trying to take your ego out of it as much as possible, where it's like, okay, do you want to like be right? Like, do you want to prove some investor wrong or a customer wrong or whatever? Or do you want to like listen and try and win? And like figure out what the game is that's being played and then just like learn how to play it, you know, as quickly as possible. So I think that's one big thing that just from the early days, stuck out to me in terms of, and it's probably a combination of conversations with you, but conversations with other people early on who, you know, who connected us to VCs and like, hey, just like when you're in meetings, you know, just shut up, like listen, write their stuff down. Like don't try and refute every, like focus on internalizing the feedback and iterating, right? Like use it to your advantage, right? If they're going to give you feedback, somebody else might have similar feedback, but like internalize it and be better as a result of it. So, you know, that's, you can never do enough of that. And I see a lot of founders who are kind of like my way or the highway, earlier in their careers. And I was, you know, there've been times where I've definitely been like that too, but like, if that's your approach, it's just a lot harder to go fast, frankly, right? Cause it's a lot harder to convince everybody to get exactly on your road, right? Versus sort of letting your road evolve into a path that can bring more people along with it naturally, right? Because you're getting...
Yeah. If you have a spot on idea and you make a spot on product that fits the market really well, and you can just not have any conversations and you just grow, awesome. Right. But the reality is like, you need partners. You need a co-founder to believe in what you're talking about and like their ideas are valuable. You need a financial partner that in most cases, especially in tech, that like they need to be part of that conversation,
right?
And you need to like listen to what they say, because most of them have been founders before and successful founders at that. And the skill set of like EQ, you know, working a room, taking your ego out of the equation. I mean, I'll think back to times when I was younger, even in this business, where like you just think you know. Mm-hmm. You just think you know. And then like you get, and when people refute you, you get like emotional, right? Like you just kind of get this feeling in your chest. Like, I want to talk. Like, I just, you know, oh man, I'm so glad that they refuted that point, cause I'm going to kill them right now. I'm just going to hit them over the head with this. And then I'll fast forward 2 years later. I was like, damn, they were right. For sure. They were right. You know, I'm eating crow. And I think, you know, enough of those makes me take a step back and go, hey, maybe I don't know. Maybe I need to start asking questions rather than telling people.
Right. And maybe they're not right about everything that they say. Like maybe somebody who's refuting you or is pushing back or is challenging you, right? Maybe they're not right about 100% of it, but there might be a kernel there that's going to be valuable to you. And so that's where it's like, you've got to meet everybody. You got to meet as many people that can touch your business as possible, right? Like, and always be storytelling about your business, because people will react to it, and then you can listen to the reactions, and you're going to learn something, right? It's your job as the founder or as the entrepreneur to try to find the kernel of truth in every piece of feedback that you get. So it's hard, right? Like, it's a lot easier to say, yeah, you know, just like put your ego aside and listen to everyone's feedback, but it really does. It really does make a difference in the long term. And then I think the other piece of advice that was very helpful for me, and I actually remember specifically watching a video. I think it was Dave McClure of 500 Startups, who has since come out. He's not been the greatest person, to put it lightly. But he has a video that is about starting companies that is very true. And I think it's called like Why You Should Not Start a Company or something like that. And it just talks about how it is really tough and it is really a long, hard road, especially in the early years. And it doesn't get easier so much as like things that are hard are different. There are new hard challenges. But it really makes you stop and think like, are you motivated to solve a problem that is important enough to you to like grind through a lot of uncomfortable times to achieve that? Or do you want to do this because you think it's cool? And there's a big difference between the two.
Let's switch gears a little bit to just the fundraising process for a tech company. Now, you don't have to fundraise. That's up to you. Technology companies, I think by nature, like require capital to get off the ground. You need to hire people on the tech side. You need to start selling to customers and things like that. And then, you know, you're a fintech company. You're a very like industry specific, and you know, you've had to go outside of Chicago to talk to investors. Like I think many entrepreneurs. Talk about your experience fundraising. Maybe some some thoughts along the way and any advice that you have for folks that are embarking on that journey.
Sure. And yeah, we could talk a whole hour about this unto itself. And I actually literally teach a lecture. Like I have a guest lecture every year that I do for a DePaul class on fundraising, early stage fundraising, because I don't know anything about late stage fundraising yet because I haven't done it. But I've done a lot of early stage fundraising. I've failed a number of times at it and then eventually figured it out. The first most important thing, regardless of this, I think is probably true. Doesn't matter what kind of company you're building in any industry, always ask yourself before you start, like, what kind of company do I want to go out and sell in the market in terms of like, right? Like, because if you're fundraising, you're selling shares of your company, right? So it is a sales process. You need to embrace and internalize that it is a sales process. And so when I say like, what kind of company am I selling, right? You need to think realistically about where do you want to go as an organization? And I don't think that as a founder, it's helpful to know like with specificity, like, oh, I want to exit in 5 years for $100 million, right? Like, sure. You don't really have that level of granularity, but knowing directionally and having confidence and rationale for why you think you'd achieve it, right? Like, do you think you have a company that's big enough to be public? And if you do, why, right? Or do you think that, you know what, my company, this market, I don't even want actually to be part of a company that could be public. I just want to have a good cash flow positive, healthy, low but steady growth lifestyle business. Or it's like, okay, great. That's also okay, right? Any way that you answer this could be fine, but it really, really dramatically changes the way that you go to market to raise capital. Because I think in the media, all we see is VC funding, VC funding, VC funding. But not every company should be VC backed. And it's not a value judgment. It's just like, if you're a VC, you are yourself running a business, right, of investing. And so you have a particular financial outcome that you are optimizing your business to achieve. And I think as founders, there's so much pressure to have like these big banner fundraise, like marquee, I raised $10 million in this, and have a big fundraising push. And like, it's a mark of success as an entrepreneur. But I think the mark of success as a founder is actually just having a really amazing company that people want to work at that solves real problems for their customers. The capital is just a means to that end. And so I've met founders who had wildly unrealistic expectations about like what they were going to raise. And when you talk to them again, like it happens where people aren't clear with themselves what kind of company they want to build. And as a result of that, they're going after the wrong type of investors. Right. So if you want to build a company that you think you could sell for $50 to $70 million, that's probably not a venture capital company, right? Because most VCs, by definition, they want 10x exits on their initial investment, right? So you can work backwards and do the math and figure out for yourself, am I going to be able to compellingly draw a story out for an investor that's a venture capitalist that is going to demonstrate for them that I could achieve a 10x return? Right? You don't have to guarantee it. Nobody would expect that. But you have to be able to have a convincing story that you could tell around why it could be a venture investment. So I think number one, you have to start there, right? And I don't know if you've seen this, you know, in other companies that you've invested in or that you've worked in, but it's probably the most common mistake is like right out of the gate.
Well, I think you have to articulate some sort of vision in a presentation, pretty short presentation,
right?
At that, you know, you're not getting to know someone over a longer period of time. And, you know, I think just like any sales process, you have to put yourself in the other person's shoes and say, you know, what's the value here for me if I'm this person? And what would I want to hear? And what information do I need to know in order to make a decision? I also think it's worth mentioning specifically because you found fintech financial services investors along mm-hmm. the way mm-hmm. that I was listening to this family office podcast that I listened to. And there's really no reason why I should be listening to a family office podcast. I'm not an investment management. I don't have a net worth anywhere close to needing to requiring a family office, let alone many family offices, Wayne's World, what reference, but learning from how those people think about things And there was a statistic out there that said most investors or high net worth individuals make their money based like very closely around their knowledge base.
Yeah.
So if they maybe started, built a company in the food manufacturing space, you know, they're just going to have less success investing in a fintech company or a recruiting services firm. So, you know, if you target using that information to target the individuals that would make sense for, and hey, I could provide value to a food manufacturing company, Right. Then you're going to have a lot of success. So, you know, my three investors and board members are in and around the recruiting services space, and they all bring a little something different. One with a finance lens, one with a leadership lens, and then one with a sales lens. And I think like those are the people that I want to go to with questions that have my back,
right,
and take this journey with me. And I think you have to think about that before you even start and reverse engineer what they're wanting to hear and
what they're wanting to add value. It's so true, because if you don't write, there's just a big misalignment. If you manage to actually convince somebody there's like no context for understanding your business to invest, I mean, good on you, because I'm always pro founders getting more capital, but sure, beware, because there probably is going to be a misalignment. And so I think it's true both of industry, and I think it's also true of, you can often tell by proxy of the kind of outcomes that an investor has had what they're going to be looking for next, right? So like if your investors have a bunch of really insane 10x exits, or they themselves were a founder that led to a VC-backed type exit, they're probably going to look for more of that.
Sure.
Because that's what they understand. And so, you know, you're totally right. Know your buyer, and know what you're selling, right? And there's tons and tons of investors out there. Like there's so many people with different risk profiles, with different financial outcomes that they're trying to achieve, with different goals of their funds or their personal wealth that they're trying to invest. Like, you know, there is an investor out there for everyone. I really do believe that. And it's just a matter of finding them. And I think ask, right? Like I think as founders, I know I was scared to ask at first. And I think as founders, we're often scared because there's such a power imbalance, especially when you're early on. So it's almost like, oh, for me in my head, I was like, who am I to ask an investor, you know, who's going to give my business capital, especially, you know, raising a few million dollars into a business. I don't even have a conception from my like personal background about what that kind of money is like. So like, it was scary and it was challenging for me. But now every time I talk to a VC, even actually before I get on a call with a new investor, I usually ask them what their financial criteria for investment is. What kind of companies do you want to invest in, and how do you like to exit? And if they don't have an answer, but they have some other proxy, that's okay. And then, you know, I ask a lot of questions on the call, like, what's your fund like? What are your investors like, right? If you're talking to a fund, they have LPs, right? So who are your investors? What are their expectations? Because that's going to have downstream effects on you in your investment partnership. How do you like to work with companies? Are you a silent check? Are you an active investor, right? Like, and know what you want, and then disqualify people. Same as a sales process, right? Oh, I want an active investor and you're just a silent check. Okay, not a good fit. Do you know anyone who might be? Right? And moving the conversation forward like that.
What's your take on, you know, this is a Chicago-based show. This whole thing is about grow Chicago, get jobs to Chicago, start companies, grow companies in Chicago. You know, we're trailing the coasts from a like a fundraising VC perspective, and then also from like an ecosystem perspective, because I think they go hand in hand a little bit. What's your take on, like, you know, you have a business in Chicago, current state Chicago kind of tech scene, or maybe over the past 5 years, and then, you know, your view as we compare to the other cities that are out there?
Yeah, it's a good question. And so for Bridge, we had to go outside of Chicago to find people that could understand the business. So we have really three key institutional investors. UMB Bank has, it's a bank in Kansas City. They have a investment arm that's sort of like an balance. I actually can't remember if it's balance sheet or a dedicated fund, but they invest as a separate thing from the bank, right? So it's UMB Capital Corp. So that's one of our key, they're our oldest institutional investor. They put in a little bit of money in 2017, and they've continued to be really great partners both in capital and in advice in those 3 years since. And then we have two other investors, a fund called FinTop is based in Nashville, St. Louis, and New York, which reflects the location of their partners. So the big name partner at that fund is Joe Maxwell and Jim McKelvey. Jim McKelvey is, of course, famous from founding Square. The partner that we work with, super talented guy, Rick Holton, he sits on our board. He's in St. Louis as well. And then there's another partner, Rick Cashel in New York and John Philpott in Nashville. Really phenomenal team. They are fintech, hardcore fintech operators. They've all been founders or operators themselves, so they get it. That was something that we told ourselves when we were raising our institutional round. We wanted a capital partner is somebody that understood our industry. But then we also said, we also want someone who understands just good old-fashioned SaaS. Like, we want a software investor because we are SaaS first and fintech second. So we want to take the best of the SaaS company learnings that exist in the market and apply them to our fintech vertical. So our other co-lead is Mission OG. It's a fund out of Philadelphia. Andy Newcomb is the managing partner there. He sits on our board. Another former operator, founder turned investor. I love working with investors like that because they get it. Like, they get the struggle and the challenges and how tough it is running a company and trying to grow a company. And so when something's tough, you don't want the investor who doesn't have experience doing it. And this is my personal preference. You want the person that you can call at 8 o'clock on a Saturday and you're like, I'm getting hit with this problem, help me. And they're like, all right, let's dig in. Let's figure it out together. So that was important to us. To zoom out and connect it back to your question on sort of the Chicago VC scene versus the coasts. In our Series A financing, I pitched over 100 different funds. So talked to funds in New York, in Boston, Philadelphia, I talked to one in Florida, in Iowa, in Illinois, like all over the country, West Coast. You said maybe I didn't talk to a fund in the Rocky Mountain region and in the South, right? That's it. The thing that I saw play out is, I really, I'm dedicated to trying to push the Chicago startup scene. And so we continue to headquarter here, even though headquartering obviously in pandemic times looks a little bit different than it used to. But we've got a long way to go still, right? That's our challenge, I think, as a city. When you look at Chicago, we're the third largest city in the country. And we are not even, I think Crunchbase, I was reading that we're not even in the top 10 in terms of cities and dollars invested last year. We've just got to do more. And it's easy for me to say, right? I don't run a fund. And it takes time, right? Silicon Valley has 50-year head start, right? But the challenge for founders then is you have to be willing to go outside of Chicago, especially early stage, because there's just not as many, right? Like, there's 1,000 seed funds in San Francisco, literally probably over 1,000, right? I think there's a couple dozen in Chicago and they're great funds. But when you think about that density, right? That density of capital, there's a lot more dollars chasing ideas. Yep. And it's a very relatively speaking, a very founder friendly environment to raise capital. So, it's a challenge. I don't have, a silver bullet. There's not a silver bullet. It's going to be reinvesting in the community. And I think also founders and funds all coming together and just taking an honest assessment of how we can get better. You're not going to get better if you're not taking an honest assessment of where you stand. And the good news is that Chicago's a great place to start a company because it's so much more economically viable. I mean, it's 64% higher living costs in San Francisco. It's 100% higher living costs in Manhattan. It's 50% higher living costs in Brooklyn, right? So it's if you're starting a company on the coast, So to put that into real numbers, right? Imagine you have $100,000 worth of salary that you're spending on, right? And if you're in San Francisco, it's 164. And if you're in New York, it's 200K just to get the same spend, right? So to put real dollars around that, that has serious implications for capital raising, dilution, the way that you go to market, your burn. It just takes way more money. Yeah. You know, talking to investors now, it seems to be that there's this growing sort of half joke where it's like, you want to start a company in the Midwest and like raise from the coasts, right? You get your coastal dollars, but you get your Midwest operational costs. And VCs are smart. They're really starting to smarten up about this. The number one type of inbound VC request I get, and I probably get one once a week, once every other week, at least, if not more. It's from coastal investors who are like, hey, we're trying to make more investments in the Midwest. Can we talk? So there's a trend, right, that's happening that's going to be, I think, favorable to Midwest founders. And I hope that it leads in turn to more funds for the Midwest, because I'm selfish. Like, I'm a Midwesterner. I've grew up in the Midwest, spent most of my life here. I want it to be Midwest funds, right? Like, I want it to be the Chicago funds that win. So again, a lot of opportunity, a lot of challenges, though.
It's so interesting to like peel this back, because if you look at the makeup of the Midwest, you have a big city in Chicago, mm-hmm. and we're right in the middle of the country. So like, you have a lot of warehouses, there's a lot of logistics that come through here, so you can get product out to everywhere else. Lots of manufacturing, which is a very like capital intensive, low margin, mostly, kind of like industry, kind of thought processes around there. The people leading those companies might think that way. And then, yeah, 50 year head start in Silicon Valley, where it's like, dump a high percentage of your net worth, right, into like 30 to 50 companies, and you're just going to get a bullet that's going to skyrocket. And that's the playbook. And I think that has like trickle down effects to what we're seeing today.
Huge.
with fundraising challenges, which lead to jobs, which leads to, you know, everything else in the city, restaurants and, you know, ecosystem stuff. There's going to be more consultants. There's going to be more Lucas James talent partners serving the industry. And it's just going to create efficiencies along the way.
So what you described, I wanted to hone in on something, the sort of like, oh yeah, like high percentage of net worth invested in early stage companies and doing angel investing, right? 30 to 50, right? And then one of them pops off. That is so true and could not be underscored more. So perfect example of this, Aaron Levy, CEO and founder of Box, right? A lot of times people think, oh yeah, he's the founder of a company that went public. He must be like multi-hundred millionaire from that company. He owned less than 4% of that company when they went public. But if you go and look at his Crunchbase profile, or if you go and look at his investments like track record on his website, or any of his, like follow him on Twitter, he has over 30 angel investments. And that includes like Airbnb and Stripe and like all these big companies that have gone themselves become huge, right? So he seeded these companies with his own money, and that has in turn helped them grow, which in turn helps him because it creates more talent density, like all the things that you talked about, right, as it grows. And so that's such a powerful effect, and it's just a matter of more and more people putting their hands up and saying like, yeah, I'm going to take more bets. Like you, I mean, you do the same thing, right? You're a prolific angel investor in the city, which is great. That those early stage dollars make a huge difference in growing that ecosystem.
I talked to somebody that's starting a fund here in Chicago. I just asked him, I'm like, hey man, like I don't talk to VCs as a potential LP. Like I'm not in that wheelhouse, mm-hmm. but because he's starting and maybe there's some value that a partnership might have, he's like, yeah, you know, maybe you can kind of come in. I'm like, okay. I'm like, who's your average person that's investing in you? If I'm a VC, who am I talking to? And it's high net worth individuals, it's, you know, family offices, it's institutionals to a certain degree, depending on your stage. And he said something very interesting to me. He's like, you know, my best go-to investor looks to invest 30% of his capital, happen to be a man, in risky investments, wow. primarily technology companies.
Wow.
And it was an older gentleman as well. And I'm like, holy cow. Okay. So probably future, I'm just looking at a profile of somebody that would think that way. Profile, you know, they're set, their kids are probably set, and they're taking that much risk because their horizon isn't like until I I pass on. Mm-hmm. It's the future of my family, or if I'm an institutional, the future of this institution. So I think the good thing is you're going to start to see this asset class like get more access from people, and people like that are going to start to allocate a bigger percentage, which is good. But we need to do that in Chicago. We need Chicago exits that don't exit like too early, right, you know, right. Because if you IPO, then you create a lot of millionaires that can reinvest that capital totally. Back into. So it's just an interesting concept. And I think if the city is looking to accelerate that, that fundraising variable trickles down into everything else. So I love talking to you about that for sure. Let's switch gears a little bit to kind of close this out. I was really interested in working with you, investing in your company. I have a very small experience level within the financial advising community. I did an internship at Merrill Lynch. I was inches to becoming a financial advisor myself. I got scared because I thought it was a daunting task to be a 22-year-old, getting dollars, frankly, from somebody else. But I learned that space. I understood the mechanics of it. I understood what a financial advisor goes through. Now, you're hitting, not necessarily, at least to start, the Merrill Lynch's of the world, the Morgan Stanley's of the world. Like, you have a product line that could get there. But your initial end user was what's called an independent registered advisor, mm-hmm. IRA. Where if somebody left a Morgan Stanley and went out on their own, mm-hmm. they don't have the resources of a Morgan Stanley or a Merrill Lynch or PNC, the internal systems, the technology, the backing, and then they need to go figure out how to get that stack on their own. So maybe take that from there, and you know, what's the product? Who are you serving? And what's the evolution of where you're looking to go?
Yeah, it's a great question. So our technology suite serves at a very high level, independent wealth managers. So what you described, right, are the people, and then the businesses are the RIAs. So it's like, we have so many acronyms in this industry. It's like IRAs are the people, but they're also the IRAs, your investment account.
RIA, that's right.
And the RIAs that it's like, anyway, we sell to the primarily to wealth managers, enterprises, and other fintechs. And what we sell is a little bit different to each of those. And so our flagship product is a software called that we call Atlas. And that focuses on automating back office work and then delivering valuable information to advisors to take action on, right? So our vision as an organization is to build a better advisor, and to do that through transforming financial data into actionable insights. What does that mean, right? Like, big vision statement, but you know, okay, what does it mean for the product kind of thing? How does it actually help people? What we've seen in the industry is an ongoing fee compression that is generally overstated, right? So when I started in wealth management in 2014, that was kind of the Betterment Wealthfront heyday, where those guys were growing like wildfire, and then they hit a saturation point about a year and a half later. And they kind of plateaued in their growth because they hit most of the consumers that they could hit, and they didn't have a B2B plan. And so why is that important for what we do? The reason it's important is because it drew a ton of attention to fees in the industry. And how much do you charge? What are you getting for that? And where's it going, right? So the fee rate for the industry on average is about 100 basis points, so 1%, just over 1%. So that means, you know, if you're $100 million in assets under management as a wealth manager, which is relatively small, actually, just as a reference point for listeners, you're making $1 million a year in revenue as a business owner if you're charging a point on, right? That fee rate, though, that average hides a lot of things in the industry. What it hides is ultra high net worth and multifamily offices have very low fee rates, like 15 to 35 basis points, because everybody wants those dollars, right?
Sure.
You have $1 billion in assets under management from like 5 clients, or $1 billion in assets under management from 100 or 1,000 clients, right? Very different business models.
And those are probably, you know, take a lot of work to serve, but there's still massive economies of scale.
Totally.
per dollar invested. I got you.
Yeah. And so what we do is we are, we help some high net worth firms, but we really start from a software standpoint, it stops being a great fit for us when firms are institutional or ultra high net worth, right? Because that's, you have complex investment structures, right? Like people invested in startups and hedge funds and VC funds, right? How do you report on those? They're complex ownership structures. You have multi-generational wealth transference that is complex and tax sensitive that you need to model out. Our software is really focused on helping advisors serve many people at scale, right? So our clients are a billion in assets, but 100 clients or 1,000 clients, right? So you need to deliver more or less the same report structure tailored to the particular client, but like 1,000 of them at scale and without taking a lot of work. So our product is very focused around serving that. Now, that changes a little bit for enterprises, and I can talk about that if we have time down the line. But from the software standpoint, it's all about how do I automate important but manual and repetitive tasks for an advisor, and then help them be a better advisor, right? By delivering information that they can take action on, right? So it's not about, hey, this client invested in this security for this 6-month time period and they had this investment return, right? That's not actually going to make a big difference for a lot of investors at the end of the day. Like the person with a $250,000 in retirement savings, and that's like their whole net worth. What they need help with is making sure that they're invested to their target risk all the time, right? Constantly, like, and you're monitoring that. Make sure that they're planning for, do their kids have college? Are their kids already drawing down in college, right? Do they have healthcare expenses that are coming up, right? It's a lot of goals and planning. And operationally, there's a lot of things that an advisor can do to improve the quality of their financial outcome. And a lot of it is around behavioral coaching, right? So if Vanguard, Vanguard's done research on this, the big ETF manager, and they estimate that 150 to 300 basis points of what they call advisor alpha, right? So performance above the expected return from an advisor comes from a variety of places, but half of it, so 150 basis points of it, so the most predictable half of it comes from behavioral coaching, right? Mm-hmm. So to restate that again, because it cannot be overemphasized, as an advisor in institutional research, 1.5 to 3% is the expected advisor alpha, right? And half of that expected advisor alpha, the predictable half of it, comes from behavioral coaching. So what does that mean for advisors? It means I have to be a better behavioral coach. It means I have to be able to synthesize a lot of information and deliver coaching insights to my clients. Well, technology is really good at synthesizing a ton of information in pattern recognition at scale, but it's not a great coach, right? Like it's a coach support, right? So I always use the example of like the Houston Rockets, right? And if they could win a championship, it would really make this metaphor work a lot better for me. but they transformed the way people played basketball because they used technology to just understand the expected outcome of shooting a three-pointer, right? It's super simple.
Got it.
But then their entire strategy as a team that the coach makes the team beholden to is centered around that insight that technology has delivered to them. And so it's very similar in the advising space, but there's not a lot of innovation being driven around that.
So just to repeat that back to you,
yeah.
I'm a financial advisor. I worked at Merrill Lynch for a little bit. I'm going out on my own. You know, typically advisors, like it's a sales job primarily. Like if you don't get clients, you go to business. So right. Like they're spending a lot of time on sales stuff
right. Throughout
the day and customer relationships, trying to get referrals, following up on referrals. But the main role is to advise them on how they should invest and manage their wealth and tax strategies and, hey, save for your kids' college and all that kind of stuff. So what you're saying is you're providing a data portal that provides actionable insights and automates tasks to say, hey, Sanjay is a customer of mine or a client of mine. Mm-hmm. Boom, I think it's time to reallocate his investment criteria in this way based on what Bridge is telling me. Boom, pop a call. He's going to get a great customer experience from this.
Right.
Boom, Rashid's, wife is due in 9 months.
Right.
Type that in there so I get a reminder maybe just after that. send a bottle of champagne and then make sure that we circle up on college funding at some point in the future. So that's great. You're taking the, you know, the CRM, the, you know, the data log for investment. Like I'm thinking like, you know, E-Trade or, Scottrade for myself or something. And then putting it all together to really serve the advisor and create a ton of ROI. And that's why I love it.
Right. I mean, because today we do a lot of report automation and stuff like that. We broadly work in this category called portfolio management software. But our technology long term is about people. It's not about investment products, right? So what you describe very well is how are you helping people achieve their goals and driving novel information to advisors to hold people accountable, right? Because like technology can find these things faster and more efficiently than a human advisor ever could, right? Like our system can tell somebody, hey, your client deposited $10,000. They usually only deposit $2,000. You need to pick up the phone and call, right? What's going on? That's a big deposit for them. That's really hard as an advisor to hold all of that in your head and then actually still go into the work of the pattern recognition and then go, and it's impossible actually, right? And so marrying the best and most powerful parts of technology with the best and most powerful parts of the human relationship, delivering better financial outcomes for people. And I mean, it's really exciting because we're just in the first innings of this. And, you know, at the end of the day, we're a data company, you know, we're not a PDF reporting company. We make sure we have PDF reports. We can do that, right? Because some older clients want that. But what we want to do is we want to transform the way that advisors deliver advice.
I love it. Rashid, let's end there. We can go on and on. I want to have you back because we're going to check in on how Bridge Financial Technology is doing in the Chicago scene. But in the interim, if folks in the Chicago community just want to reach out to you, learn more about you or more about your company, where can they find you? Where can they learn a little bit more about Bridge?
Sure. People are welcome to go to our website, bridgeft.com. I'm on LinkedIn. I don't have a Twitter. I probably should. People can email me as well. So if you want to include that, and like any people who are thinking about founding companies, reach out to me. I love working with other founders. I love helping people hopefully avoid some of the mistakes that we made along the way. So I'm happy to connect and be available.
I love it. Thanks so much, Rashid. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
All right, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rashid. Definitely check him out. Follow Bridge Financial Technology on LinkedIn. They're going places. They're doing a lot of great things. Hope you enjoyed the episode. We have many, many, many other guests that are previously recorded that are coming up in the next several weeks. So if you haven't already, make sure that you subscribe. Thank you so much for your time, attention, and support. Thanks again, and until next time.